Hello. It's good to talk with you one last time. Summing up any term is always more difficult than it looks. At least it looks when you think, well, all I have to do is teach one more class. This term is hard to sum up in an unusual way. I've learned now, over the course of the last three terms that have been interrupted by the epidemic, that the class that has never actually met all in one place never began, and therefore never actually ends. It's an inevitable consequence of the relationship between teaching and theater, which is as old as the mastery of fire. For it is when there is a fire that the work of the daytime, which is the individual instruction of two human beings working together to chip a stone and make a knife, or collect a grain, or hunt an animal. When there is a fire in the nighttime to produce safety and warmth and a shared experience of being together, then a kind of teaching and a kind of theater and a kind of storytelling can emerge in the human race. And when at the other end of the story, as far as we know it, a shared nervous system, exoskeletally fastened across the entirety of the human species, so that all human beings are in some intermediated form in touch with all other human beings actually or potentially all the time, the condition of changed society, which we now call the internet, at the other end of the story, where human beings live in that way, the intimacy of the campfire, of the theater, of the classroom, which really wasn't intimacy at all, but rather the human yearning for something larger than we are, which can be put within the compass of a room, a space, a time, that little wooden O, and which can now instead be satisfied everywhere all the time by an intimacy yet less intimate, but more controlling, which has, within your lifetime, become the way that being human is. And so summing up is difficult because the sum is constantly changing. As a consequence of a change in what it means to be the sum, which has occurred so recently in the 5 million year long history of being us, since we and the chimpanzee cousins ceased genetic cohabitation. A whole 1.5% or so of the genome separating us from the cousins with whom we are as closely connected as you could possibly want to be, and over all that time, it was only in your lifetime, the briefest, most insignificant temporally minuscule portion of the smallest fraction conceivable in the sum of time. That everything became different. Happened in my lifetime too, but my lifetime was just a little bit longer and started with all this gear a little bit earlier. And that couple of decades means that what the summing up is to me is over just an infinitesimally smaller interval. But on the day that Mike Montalbano and I started working together at IBM in 1979, after Mike had been at the 1946 delivery at the National Bureau of Standards of the world's first digital computer for civilian use, my extra little portion of a lifetime carries us back to one degree of separation from the beginning of it all. That seems, at the moment, at least to me, maybe even to you, like a sufficiently additional capaciousness of perspective actually to be able to offer some interpretation. But in the long life of what is going to happen to the human species from here on out, it's not even the flickering of an eyelash. We are all trying to grasp in this one moment when we talk about the relationship between citizens and the state, the most vital to us, but equally, well, minuscule aspect of everything that has been changed, about which we have for a few weeks been trying to create some historical perspective for the purpose of understanding. In summing over that, my task, as I have already suggested, feels burdensome because of how obviously inadequate any present judgment is to an actual historical view of what has occurred around us. I have backed up far enough to get a running start in thinking about the constitutional machinery which has come with us into this new era of the human race. But that doesn't mean that I can run any distance past what all of us see around us. And to the extent I can, it reflects not an ability to foresee the future, but the particular problem of the historian with the concept of the present. For most human beings, most of the time, the present is a place called now, where things are happening that will be remembered after they have occurred and that were apprehensively anticipated before they arrived. For the historian, however, the present is a more complicated construct consisting, after all, of things happening which, as Ambrose Bierce said of accidents in the Devil's Dictionary, are inevitable occurrences owing to the action of immutable natural laws, as well as the extraordinary tapestry of the role of contingency in human affairs, which is the historian's primary subject of inquiry. But the present is a smeary thing consisting of that which is presently occurring under the inevitable physical forces that arose in the past, and the portions of what we are inclined to call the future, which are actually the inevitable outcomes of physical processes occurring now. I used to have to offer students the parables of automobiles spinning on icy highways and other forms of science fiction in order to explain the fact that some portion of the future has already become predetermined in what we are inclined to call the present, and that the two are therefore actually part of the same time frame, even if the car hasn't yet smacked the telephone pole, which only physics says that it will hit. But that form of explanation, which I've been offering to history students and law students all my life, can now be left behind for a truly smeary form of the present, which is understood to be the climate of the earth and the chemistry of the carbon cycle as disrupted by human industrial activity. We began in what is now thought of as the past, a series of burnings liberating carbon into the atmosphere, which have, over the course of the long present, produced a chemistry in the existing atmosphere which inevitably affects the climate of the earth in what we are still inclined to call the future. And this form of the present, in which only physics and chemistry that will occur separate us from a social condition we recognize as ours, from another social condition we consider alien, those actually equally occupy a present linked by the inevitability of the chemistry already done. And in this way, for a decade or two, one can hypothesize, not with the certainty of physical law, but with the recognition of that which is already happening in this indistinct quantum present of ours, while the network comes to be the nervous system of every human mind's connection, actual or potential, to every other human mind and to a variety of other intellectual organisms, all existing from birth to death in that human being's version of the net. When we recognize that that is already the present reality happening in what we think of as the future, it becomes easy to say why that early architect of the net we know, my friend Dan Geer, says that this is the last generation in which the human race gets a choice. I hope now, at the beginning of the end of what would be the final part of this course, if this course had ever really begun and if it ever had an ending, I hope that in this near one end of the Möbius strip, it is now clearer what I meant he meant by that when we met ourselves at the beginning of this course. The choice the human race now faces is how to bring into the new era of human history and the new forms of social relationship that emerge when we share one species-wide collective nervous system, what happens to certain values embedded in the 18th century constitutional language of a particular set of rights, which came in the course of the 20th century to have a large influence over other portions of the human race for the first time, the survival of which is now uncertain, given the overwhelmingly broad implications of the human change ushered in by our invention of some digital wiring. The choice is not binary only, though it is mostly binary. That binary aspect of the choice is the one presently being captured in the conversations around the new U.S. administration and in the voice of the President of the United States, a figure of the old human race, if ever there was one, who says that we are in a period of confrontation between democracy and autocracy in new forms. Implicit in that proposition is that there is an improved form of autocracy being pioneered by the Chinese Communist Party in the culture of a rising People's Republic of China, which takes very seriously the power of the new nervous system to create harmony and order in the human species in an autocratic mode, which it regards as itself the perfection of a Chinese cultural history, which is very long and very distinguished. And there is the comparatively unformed, but intellectually increasingly clarified form of democracy that came into existence using 18th century ideas and 20th century industrial power to establish a brief, nearly species-wide form of social organization, and which now, even by its own leadership, feels under significant challenge, but which did the fundamental inventing of the anatomy of the species-wide nervous system of the human race we call the Internet, and which raised up within itself not only forms of capitalist technology making, which created the physiology of the present net with the parasite, with the mind of God living in a nested form within it, but also created the forms of techno-sharing, anarchist-sharing, expressive sharing, arts that cannot be limited by the powers of wealth and government sharing, my corner of which, an early part of the growth, was called the free software movement, but which ultimately wanted to establish a non-utopian politics, a politics of proof of concept plus running code, bottom-up developed physiology for the nervous system of the entire human race, which was based around the principle of respecting human users' rights, and which expressed itself in terms of make freedom, put freedom in everything, turn freedom on. A modulation of late 19th century political economy, which we still called socialism, proudly, with the structures of self-understanding raised by being at the very earliest edge of the construction of the nervous system for the human race we called the net, when we were still the ones laying the wires and still the ones laying down the software which made the earliest part of the physiology, when we still understood it to be a thing conceived, not a thing given. And therefore, when we, though we were merely children, considered ourselves to have equal power in its construction with anybody else who, like us, just had the knack of rendering it in code, I can't only just sum up from there. I had to go through the whole process with you from there. That is to say, I can't forget where I came from and forget where you came from, and forget the difference between T1 and T0, in trying to evolve an argument, but at the other end of this story, after another generation of human beings has come and gone and left its children to run our world, all of this will appear to have happened in a blink. And there will be no difference between my perspective at T0 and yours at T1, between the end of the process that gets us to T2, the human race will have made its choice. What we have been doing up until now, the end of this course, is understanding particular facets of that choice. The facets were found on the face of the diamond that is the United States Constitution, though it is apparent that if you have to chip a rock so it looks good, some of those same facets will appear everywhere you do the work. This stone happens, as I have tried to show, to emerge its principles about search and seizure, and its principles about freedom of expression, and its principles about fair trial, and its principles about what it is that we have kept after we have finished making a constitution, and that all those various expressions, facets of the stone that was cut some 240 years ago, and if you count the time we broke it and glued it back together again like a flawed emerald in the middle of the 19th century, we have pretty much kept, even as we used it to power our way through changes of society that no 18th century person could in fact have conceived. And in the process of trying to understand how those facets of the stone were originally shaped and cut, and how they grew in the course of the 20th century's industrial development of the technologies of communication and storage, and what we were left with by way of the bones of constitutional rights at the moment that we began stretching this nervous system across society inside the United States and around the world, and what this now means, that we've spent our time on. I hope that some tentative clarity has been created on that subject. What the choices are in more detail that comprise the choice we make this generation. In trying to set that question, what in detail is the choice, I have also tried to show that in any analysis of a gesture, no matter how genetic or how impracticably detailed in the actual epigenetic rubbing up against one another that we do in society, we cannot succeed unless we understand each phenomenon technically, legally, and politically. Three different things. Admittedly, the process of distinguishing the law from politics is vexing, sometimes too vexed to be achieved. But here we have been using an understanding of the law which is descriptive, and an understanding of politics which is also descriptive, and we have understood at least that those descriptions are orthogonal to one another. Technology, too, is not distinguishable from law and politics in a pure sense, because what we think of as the march of technology is magnetically distorted in its trajectory by forces that allocate and distribute power in society, and that do so using structures of words, the purpose of which is to replace force. But the technology is never purely the politics or the law. It embraces facts about the way that semiconductors work, and it embraces understandings of the way that software can be made. So we take to every step in the process of understanding what the choice is facing this generation, technological and legal and political analyses, and they are distinct and they overlap. And it is in their consilience, the technical understandings, the understandings about the political structures, institutions, practices, and cultures in society that distribute power, and the particular forms which are the law, it's in the consilience of those explanations that we come to understand the choice that we have made, are making, will make, and how those verb tenses conceal instead the smeary quantum nounness of both our past and our future in relation to what we perceive to be our present. But here at the supposed end, we are actually also doing something that has a different valence from our preceding effort to understand what is the choice, because here at what we are pleased to think of as the end, it is now our job also to understand how to effectuate the choice when we have made it. Implicit in the distinction between democracy and autocracy, between the binary possibility of perfected despotism at zero, or the completion of the autonomy of every human being, learning what every brain wants to learn without regard to the ability to pay or to the whims of government, and thereby, by true universal education, able to implement some form of informational democracy in which, in the permanent fact in the human race that information is power, it becomes possible for people to exercise power to govern their own lives and collectively to govern themselves. In order to achieve that outcome binarily, so that we fall not to the zero of perfected despotism, but forward to the end of an informational democracy that provides genuine human equality and that recognizes the development of each as the development of all. Which, when there is a single nervous system spanning the species, is truly, really the only way that you can conceive the development of either each or all. As though one actually could specify which cells in a human body should be developed at any given moment in order for the body as a whole to have a good day, or to be growing, or to thrive. As it is evident that we are trying to fall forward to absolutely one and to avoid falling backward to absolutely zero, it is apparent that the choice that we are making is the choice that leads us in this quantumness where zero and one are unspeakably trivial approximations. We are trying actively from day to day in our lives and in the lives of the societies where we live, we are trying to set a velocity and a direction. And in doing so, we are, in some primary Heisenberg sense, forsaking any absolute measurement of position. But for that, we need to understand technology and politics and law. About the tragedy of the Fourth Amendment, I have said not merely all the things I tediously said about the historical relation between the law of the English-speaking peoples and the forms of their governments and the outcome of the principle of how to gather evidence for criminal prosecution. Far more than that, I have said searching and seizing, the maintenance of the zone of privacy around a human being in which she is able to stand off the determination of the power of the state to know whatever it is convenient for the state to know, that right depends now ultimately not on the law and the politics of the past, but on the ways in which the technology of the present and the future can be used to infuse those old legal principles, those old political understandings, with new operational relevance. Left to its own devices, I have said, the principles of the Fourth Amendment will not serve our purposes in 21st century America, nor will they provide the appropriate working models for the standard of the physiology of law enforcement in other societies that can maintain or create freedom, regardless of local constitutional provisions and how they're phrased. It's not the wiring only that is the problem. But with the understanding that people's rights depend upon their behavior, that there are both technical, or I should say legal forms of the waiver of rights and practical, that is political forms of the waiver of rights, and that unwaivable rights which cannot be alienated no matter by what degree of human indifference are, if they exist at all, ghosts seen in the law, as Holmes says, hard to grasp. So, about our ability to maintain privacy as against the state, which is unquestionably one of the fundamental requirements if we are to move towards one and away from zero, requires that rights not be waived technologically, which neither politics nor law will find it easy to unwaive in truth down the road. Hence, I have attempted to emphasize the importance of the forms of technology which will allow people to maintain their privacy. In A Course That Never Ends, I don't have to perform the technological exercises within the period of the semester. And so, over the next couple of weeks, I will post all the technical exercises from last term's course and from this one on the front page of this course, so that people may pursue those exercises for themselves and gain the various forms of technological control, which, in addition to the Freedom Box, which we have repeatedly discussed and which some people have begun experimenting with in this course, are examples of what I mean by the technological dimensions of the non-waiver of rights, of privacy, of search and seizure, of security in the persons, houses, papers, and effects of 21st century people, whether in America or elsewhere, wherever the technologies can be made to work. And I have said that the comedy of the First Amendment shows us how the process of technological change, which requires the constant restructuring effort of government, either in the direction of zero or of one, but of course in the great quantum smeariness of all of this, neither ever the perfection of despotism only, or the protection of the freedom to know and the freedom to learn and the ability of every human being to develop develop herself, himself, itself, their self, all their selves, all the important ways. The inevitability of the state being involved at every level of detail, from the wire in the house to the largest structure of what we are still pleased to call the media, though they are really the medium of growth in the petri dish that is the single worldwide colony of the human race, evolving together now from moment to moment in nerve cell connection. We can see how a principle that no law shall be made abridging the freedom of speech or of the press will, where the press has metastasized and become each and every one of us, every moment, everywhere, where the machine that allows us to communicate is no longer fully anatomically distinguishable from that of the human body itself, that the principle that government shall make no law abridging the freedom within that network of the people can be put to enormous use, precisely because whatever technology can do, the politics and the law of the principle of non-abridgment of free expression can liberate from anything but the most compelling forms of law made in an informational democracy, which is as much an outgrowth of the freedoms of its expression as the Jeffersonian democracy of American constitutional vision depended upon the freedom of the press when it was still the thing of wood and iron that Jefferson and so many of his contemporaries in this rebellious part of the world put their lead into. And I have said in summing up that in that nervous system where everyone is connected and where the state surveils and capitalism surveils and everybody pools their surveillance to infer, that what we do in our processes of justice, when we try things, when we establish facts, when we give to the community the crucial role of being the ultimate arbiter of what happens before power in the coercive excesses of the state can be applied to it, what we do there depends ultimately upon our ability to translate into the physiology of the network's behavior principles of process, which are in some ways antithetical to the very operation of the network itself. Inhibitions, in the truest biological sense, entrenched not merely as matters of constitutional law, but built into the fabric, for which only a politics that fully understands the relationship of those old trial rights in a particular legal system have been generalized to the point at which they can be conceived, like Asimov's laws of robotics, as ethical principles that the software physiology of our built environment must mandatorily reflect. These then are facets of a single decision being made by the human race this generation. A decision which can be cast as conflicts of cultures, Manichaean binary structure of democracy and autocracy. If you want to have a vision of the ultimate meaning of the choice. But the making of the choice is what occurs in your lifetime. Yours is the generation that makes the choice, and it wouldn't do very well just to describe what the choice is without also explaining, like the pictogram diagram on the bus, how you actually use the emergency exit. The choice being made, now we can be precise after all this time, the choice being made is to bake into the physiology of our network a series of inhibitions which arose in the course of the last 500 years as principles of constitutional liberty in a small corner of the human race. To take those elements of human value and to codify them, not now in purely a legal sense, but more in purely a technical sense, to put them in the code. When my dear friend and comrade Larry Lessig argued at the beginning of the century that there was such a thing as code doing the work of law, he was indeed anticipating the reality of code doing the work of constitution. But it isn't alone in doing that work. It is part of systems of law and politics as well. And therefore, in making this choice, we are committing ourselves to issues of technological design, and also to forms of law and politics with which that design is intended to work. It is, just to give the smallest of examples, worth making technology that stores everything about us in our homes, rather than in the presence of some third-party data intermediaries, precisely because it is in our homes that our law, which reflects the human values of our politics, believes that it is most definitely the human being's right to be private from the state, and which therefore requires the state to use its best foot forward before its most neutral magistrate in order to get, at any time, the right to use force to put itself inside the home. The technology of constitutional privacy reflects that by putting things in the home that belong in the home, the persons, houses, papers, and effects of citizens to be not unreasonably insecure. Unlike the other places where reasonable insecurity has indeed always been a necessary consequence of the way the built environment and the legal rules and the politics of the sacredness of home together work. But to effectuate choices for the continuance of the privacy rights of the Fourth Amendment is not merely to have a technological proposition. It is, after all, also to have law, statute law, we should assume, law made in the process of understanding the way legislatures can and constitutional conventions can't, the relation between the needs of policing and the needs of the citizen's privacy at any given time, subject always to fundamental constitutional inhibition. In order to effectuate that choice, that is to say, we need, as I said in the Snowden lectures, to subject state listening, that is, interception of information, traveling in the nervous system of the society to forces absolutely governed by the rule of law. In the United States, we mostly had achieved that at the end of the 20th century, even though we had also built an empire of listening, which pretty much took everything that could be taken pretty much everywhere in the world except here, at home, within our boundaries. It is not purely the result of indifferent or negligent or constitutionally malevolent policies that we gave that clarity away, as I tried to point out in the first and second Snowden lectures. Technology reshaped the nature of the distinction between home and away into one too theoretically complex to be used as a simple boundary anymore. But also, our political leadership tampered with our justice, and we fell. Nonetheless, it is within our power to achieve, by legislation, a reinstitution of the rules that the late 20th century had accomplished, and which take further account of the extraordinary increase in the government's responsibility to protect citizens from spying outside. The protective function of the government's relationship to our nervous system was less important, even as we built it, than it is now. Precisely because that conflict between autocracy and democracy is occurring in a world in which all governments of power and force have equally agreed that spying from outside can't be prevented and that no serious attempt to do so should be made. All the major technological societies continue to be of an implicit agreement that government listening within societies will occur, and that extraterritorial listening by governments will occur, and that the race is essentially a free fire zone for such exfiltration, and that nobody should do anything about it. That was the position in the relations between the US and the Europeans and the Chinese in, let us say, the first Obama administration, and it remains the undergirding reality now. But that should change. The great objective of privacy legislation in these developed societies now should be to subject all domestic listening to the rule of law and to require government to use its best efforts to protect against spying from outside and to assist all private interests in securing themselves against external spying, even where that means the government's own ability to listen under the rule of law may be adversely affected. There is no immediate likelihood that such legislation can be passed, as there was at any given moment before the Patriot Act, no reason to believe that legislation so aggressively deteriorative of civil liberties could pass. But in the United States after the Second World War, the national security state's instruments and the national policing system constituted a permanent lobby for the eventual passage of all the legislative influences that could increase the power of the government to keep order through listening, and which took advantage of every opportunity to put into the political process the next round of its initiatives. The civil liberties community and the constitutional civil liberties community in the United States has, however, over almost the entirety of its existence, and for this purpose, certainly throughout the period after the rise of the national security state after the Second World War, the civil liberties community, the constitutional civil liberties community, has been defensive in its outlook with respect to legislation. It has primarily tried to prevent, sometimes with success and sometimes after the opportunism of the forces of security was justified, unsuccessfully, they have attempted to prevent the forces of security inside government from making their best running. They have attempted to prevent legislative harm. But the positive case, the active engagement with the legislative process for the purpose of making and holding incremental improvements in the same way that the forces of security in society have sought incrementally to improve their own position, has not been the nature of our constitutional civil liberties movements. ACLU has not been an effective force on Capitol Hill in my lifetime. There are many ways of describing why that's true, but the most important way of describing why it's true is not to concentrate on the vagaries of any particular organization or its leadership. The effectuation of the choice this generation makes requires a form of politics of civil liberty and informational democracy which leans forward and which is constantly engaged in the effort incrementally to enact its purposes with the same degree of effort expended by the forces of security and order within government. And this is the United States, where that task is at least conceivable, requiring a new generation of leadership and a new structure of organizations and a new form of political campaigning, no doubt, but nonetheless conceivable. Its occurrence outside the United States requires even more difficult activity within societies and requires the power and usefulness of the United States as a positive example. I tried to talk last time about the form in which the effectuation of choice in the building of the 21st century First Amendment occurs, and I shan't repeat all of that here, but point instead to the salient elements of that conversation. The regulation of presently existing social networking is inevitable over the next decade, and the form that regulation will take, though it is undoubtedly unclear at this moment, is unlikely to be precisely in the direction of the effectuation of the right of every brain on earth to learn whatever it wants, however it wants, whenever, without regard to the ability to pay or the whims of government, and is unlikely to be based on the principle that the development of each is the development of all. It is likely to be narrow and self-serving and politically expedient legislation. It is likely to be accompanied by wasteful efforts to use competition law to deal with a situation only one part of which is worsened by oligopoly. But the process of reviewing that legislation will require deep understanding of the application of the principles of freedom of expression, freedom of speech and of the press, academic freedom, freedom of thought, freedom to read, freedom to listen, freedom to exchange views, and also freedom from intimidation and harassment, and the language of the street inside the space that is the home. And all of this is going to be worked out, therefore, in a process of indistinct evocation of principle by legislation inadequate even to its limited and probably only partially beneficial purposes. But participation in that dialogue, in the courts, in the legislature, in the politics of the society, is the effectuation of the choice this generation to continue to prioritize those rights while other societies use the technology to extinguish them. No one who wishes to think about the informational democracy of the United States can afford ever to forget the ongoing destruction of the informational democracy that might have been Hong Kong. Hong Kong is, to the history of the 21st century, what Budapest and Prague are together to the political history of Europe in the middle of the post-war period. But our understanding of the crucial importance of the principles of the freedom of speech and of the press will not be sufficient without both the technology and the law that will result from the effort now to regulate the oligopolists of behavior collection. In whatever way that regulation occurs and in whatever forms it is articulated, and the effectuation of the choice in our time is not about that regulation, but about the terms in which it will be discussed. Everywhere there is convenience, which we can in this context define as value for citizens, better uses of their tax money and better services in receipt from government, there is convenience in the use of the nervous system to improve the ways in which the state studies problems, analyzes information, and delivers services. The constitutional principles that governed the transparency and publicity of the criminal trial in the 18th century apply themselves also to a whole variety of other processes by which the state ascertains facts and takes actions in the 21st. This is why concerns about the fairness of algorithms suddenly appear in a world in which the jury is replaced by algorithm, in which locality, human beings, non-specialist but trusted for their very integration into the community, in which human beings' decisions are ultimately replaced by decisions made by automated processes that have in turn replaced bureaucracies. Our effort to understand Sixth Amendment rights is not merely an effort to understand the evolution of the criminal trial under the rule of convenience, but a way of understanding beyond that the difference between what we asked of government in the era of our own non-interconnected but deeply community-based and therefore thought to be reliable forms of human intelligence, and increasing reliance by citizens and the state on principles which replace human intelligence derived from community with something inappropriately called artificial intelligence, which does not represent the way machines think or how we can think better with machines, but which reflects instead a form of active self-deception about both our intelligence and that of the machines we make, which is leading us, well, towards zero rather than one, let us say. Technologies of freedom we have and can make profusely. And the legislation of freedom, which I also describe from another point of view in the summing up lectures in Law and the Internet Society in the fall, which those of you who weren't there might find it interesting to consult. None of us were there, you understand, but I mean, those of us who haven't yet listened to the audio of those closing summing ups in Law and the Internet Society because we had to rather than because we wanted to. If we think in terms of the necessary legal material, we can agree that after some iterative process over the next quarter century, we will start to get it right. But the real exercise of the choice is contained not in the technologies of freedom or in the processes of better legislation, but in the politics which facilitates the development of both, which is the politics of informational democracy. Louis XIV said that victory lies with the last gold piece, which is a reasonable way of describing the nature of the political basis of power in the Europe which had just finished by 150 years or so plundering all the loose gold of the Western Hemisphere. And victory in the 20th century belonged to the last liter of gasoline as we moved intensively into a world of things moving on the ground and moving in the air powered by the burning of fossil fuel. And victory after Midway belonged to those who could listen to the radio signals of the other side better, faster, and do something about it quicker, which led to the world of listening to everything and the Pax Americana, as I described it in the first of the Snowden lectures. But in the 21st century, it is the flow of information about people and their behavior which is power. And informational democracy means giving people power over that information, both to withhold it from collection and to have access to the forms of social understanding and therefore social influence that it provides. And on the politics of informational democracy, we are not different, you and I, because I had another couple of decades to think about it. Technological understanding and the relations between the depth of technological fact and the superficiality of existing law, it is possible to be a little better at for having had a little more time to think about it. But on the depth of what it means to choose informational democracy in our societies, those who know are everyone, or those who can know are everyone, and everyone's vote counts. It is possible to argue that the subject matter of this course is less important than the warming of the earth. I think about that a good deal. My life is bent to one of those questions, and some of the dearest people in the world to me have bent their life to the other question, and I do not know. But I can say with confidence that there is no third problem anywhere near as significant or important to the future of the human race as these two, and I now submit to you that we have done enough together to bring you to the place where you can have influence and significance in the human grappling with this problem. Both that you know what the human race's choices are, and you know how that choice will, in the near and not so near future be exercised in your lifetime with irreversible and deeply significant consequences for every human being ever thereafter. I don't know anybody I'd rather commit this future to. I don't know anybody who more ought to be looked upon for the human by the human race as people who can help it make its choice. I do know that it is likely that the very smallest proportion of you, now that you have been subjected to the tedium of this, have any actual inclination to be part of making that choice. There's nothing like summing up to bring a sense of self-doubt. I did what I could about all this. But I have passed into the portion of my life in which it isn't my doing, but my teaching, which is most important. And there's no time like the present for wishing that one's teaching were better. But here it is. I leave it to you not because I would, but because I must. And I leave it to you on the basis that you must at least consider what it will mean not only to you, but to all those who follow you, whether in the end this turned out to be the thing you needed as a lawyer and as a citizen to work on. Thank you very much.